This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. I did have a few errands that I needed to run today, and so I took care of those first. So this is going to be a little shorter than usual because I'm only going to have about a 12-minute drive home, 15 minutes, somewhere in there. But I have actually been getting a little verbose on the backside of these things, and I think the last one was like 35 minutes. This is supposed to be a 20-minute commute. So maybe by the time I'm verbose at the end and I get back, then, you know, it'll come out about right, which is supposed to be about 20 minutes. Anyways, been a good week. Been a long week. Been working through some stuff and revising some stuff. And, you know, it's been one of those weeks where you're just grinding through. But I don't think I'm coming in tomorrow unless there is some crisis. And plan to get a good day of work, a good day of writing in tomorrow. I'm up to 43,000 words, something like that. I'm actually planning on taking a little time off this evening. And then tomorrow morning, I'm going to see if I can hit it hard and get close to striking range of being finished next week, as far as getting things blocked in. Then as soon as I get that done, I need to turn around and start my taxes because I haven't done that yet. So anyways, all is well. I think I pretty much know where the pieces are going with Farforth Fable 2. I'm thinking that I'm a little short, one or two chapters worth, so I may have to come up with some kind of extra little something towards the end, but we're going to be close. We're going to be really close, so we'll see. We'll see. It'll be interesting. And it hasn't quite ended up where I thought it was going to end up. So, which is fine. Sometimes books just take off and have a life of their own, which is okay. This past week, I've been coming across a lot of good topics lately where I think, oh yeah, I'd like to talk about that. Oh, that was cool. And one of them was a TED Talk I had watched called How a Fly Flies, which I thought, oh, well, this will be interesting because I had heard, without really doing much research, that scientists had supposedly proven that it was impossible for bees to fly given their wing structure, yada, yada, yada. And the guy actually talks about that in this TED Talk, along with a lot of other things that I found fascinating. Because I have a healthy respect for flies. I mean, they're pretty good at what they do. You really have to kind of be on your game if you're going to catch a fly, because they react so quickly. So, anyways, this guy started off his talk in a way that is always fun for me. Years and years ago, although not completely apropos in this instance, years and years ago, my son-in-law and I were talking. At that point, I'm not sure he was my son-in-law yet, but we were talking and I made the claim that a lot of the things that are getting invented today were actually inspired by Star Trek. And he guffawed at me. Said, come on, what? No. I said, yeah. I said, a lot of these people who are engineers now are trying to invent things were kids growing up watching classic Trek. You know, the whole flip phone thing. Remember when we had those? And that was from Star Trek. And And so as the years have gone by, whenever I've read a scientist talking about his journey and path to discovery and what has caused him to go down the path he has, and whenever they say, yeah, well, Star Trek, I saw that, I would always forward that to him. And as I said, this is not entirely apropos, but this guy did start his talk. By the way, his name is Michael Dickinson, D-I-C-K-I-N-S-O-N. The TED Talk is How a Fly Flies. He did start off his talk by saying, I grew up watching Star Trek. I love Star Trek. Star Trek wanted to make me see alien creatures from a far distant world. He said, basically, I figured out that I could find those alien creatures right here on Earth. And so what he does is he studies insects. And there were just a few things. He was funny. He was, did a great job with his talk. Talked real fast. He said he used to talk slower when he studied mice, but then he started studying insects and he got to the place where he talked much faster. So it was a good talk. You should watch it if you have time. And he was demonstrating some of the abilities that flies have. He said that he showed a video sequence where they shot it at 7,000 frames a second. 7,000 frames a second, so they could slow it down. And he said, I've carefully cropped the sequence to be exactly the duration of a human eye blink. And he said, watch what happens in this. And you see this fly flying in. He had put the scientist had put some kind of electronic predator on there so that the fly would react to it. You see this fly flying in. You see its legs going, extending out in reaction to the predator. And then poof, he changes course and he's off in another direction. This all happens, blink of an eye. Boom. And he says, in a blink of an eye, this fly has seen the looming predator. He has estimated its position. He has initiated a motor pattern to fly away and is beating his wings at 220 times a second to get all that accomplished, which is really amazing. And he says, so this thing, the thing that flies do, really, what does it take? And he said, well, it's pretty much what a human takes to fly. You got to have wings that are sufficient to generate sufficient aerodynamic forces. You need an engine sufficient to generate the power required for flight. You need a controller, et cetera, et cetera. So the flies have all these things. And he mentioned right at the beginning of his talk what I said he was going to mention. And he said, you might have heard how engineers proved that bumblebees couldn't fly. And he said, well, the problem was thinking that insect wings function the same way aircraft wings work. And he said, they don't. He said, as it turns out, he said, insects flap their wings in a very clever way. He said, they flap their wings at a very high angle of attack, and that creates a structure at the edge of the leading edge of the wing. It's sort of like a tornado structure. And he said they call it a leading edge vortex. And so because insects flap their wings in this way and create this vortex actually enables the wings to make enough force for the animals to stay in the air. It's a very sophisticated technique. Very interesting. He said also what's interesting about flies is they actually have two different flight muscles. He said the first type of flight muscle is the strength muscle. And he said a stretch activated muscle, and it does not need to be controlled on a contraction by contraction basis by the nervous system. So it's this specialized muscle that is generates the power that's required for flight, and it fills the whole middle portion of the fly. So he said, when a fly hits your windshield, he said, basically what you're seeing is that power, what's left of that power muscle after it hits your windshield. He said, but what you don't see is that there's these tiny little control muscles that are down at the base of the wing that can actually, you know, tilt and bend the wing and do everything that's necessary. And he says they're very fast. And he said they're able to configure that hinge on the wing on a stroke-by-stroke basis. Mind you, this wing is going at 220 beats per second. And he said, and that's what enables the fly to change its wing and generate these amazing changes in aerodynamics. He said flies also have really sophisticated sensors. Said they have antenna that sends odors and detect wind. Said they have a sophisticated eye, which is the fastest visual system on the planet. Said they have another set of eyes on top of their head, and he said, frankly, we have no idea what they do. He said their wing is covered with sensors that can sense what the deformation of the wing is. He said they can even taste with their wings. Said one of the most sophisticated sensors that the fly has is called, I'm probably not going to pronounce this, halteres. He said they're actually these little gyroscopes. And the devices beat back and forth at 200 hertz during flight, again, 200 times a second. And the animal can use them to sense its body rotation and initiate very, very fast corrective maneuvers. I mean, all this stuff is really amazing to me. And he said the fly does all this with the brain that has 100,000 neurons. That's it. Just 100,000 neurons. And the guy went on to point out, he said that this type of brain is actually the most common brain on the planet. Not the big brains like we have that have 100 billion neurons, but these small little brains with 7,000 neurons, 100,000 neurons. And he said what's really interesting about studying these brains is that they don't really know how they work yet. They're getting some clues, but these little brains that have these 100,000 neurons are just amazing. And he actually had a picture of a mouse, a beautiful image of a visual interneuron from a mouse that came from somebody else's. And then he showed a neuron from one of these flies' brains next to it. And of course, it's just minuscule. It's just amazing. He says, so, he said, given this, given all the sophisticated maneuvers that these flies are doing, I'm getting my mail, one moment. How in the world do they manage all this stuff with this minuscule little brain? And for me, aside from just being amazed at all of the things that the fly could do, this is where it starts to get amazing. He said when he was blowing up the picture of the little fly neuron, whoops, didn't get turned quite tight enough because I'm backing up. He said, you know, it's a really beautifully complex little neuron. It's just very, very tiny. And he said there's lots of biological challenges that arise when you're trying to compute information with tiny, tiny neurons. He showed a picture of another insect, very, very small. I'm backing into my garage. And yet, it has all the basic pieces. You know, it has the sensors, it has the wings, it's doing all the stuff that you would expect a fly to do. Except, I think, yes, This little guy, his brain is the size of a grain of salt. He said, which is comparable for a fruit fly. It's the size of a grain of salt. And this is where it starts getting interesting for me. And he said, when you're talking about something that small, then, how do you take that small number of neurons and make it do all these complex things? And he said, I think from an engineering standpoint, you think of multiplexing. From an engineering standpoint, mind you. Yes. He said, you take hardware and you have that hardware do different things at different times and have different parts of the hardware doing different things. And these are the two concepts I'd like to explore. In fact, as they've been working on this, they're discovering that the neurochemicals, when they come into these neurons, that the chemicals that are released actually make these neurons behave in different ways. So you do get this multiplexing effect. And in addition to that, where our neurons basically fire in sequence, these tiny little neurons, if I understood what he was saying correctly, those tiny little neurons, actually different parts of them can be doing different things simultaneously. So they really are multiplexing. And this was just fascinating to me. He said, let me just read that for you. He called them non-spiking neurons, not neurons that aren't just firing the whole thing at the same time. Said, but non-spiking neurons are actually quite complicated because they have input synapses and output synapses all interdigitated, which means they're all clustered together. And there's no single action potential that drives all the outputs at the same time. So there's a possibility that you have a computational compartments that allow different parts of the neurons to do different things at the same time. In other words, what he's saying is that while the neurons in our brain work a certain way because that wasn't going to work down for the fly, then lo and behold, the neurons for the fly don't work that way. They work in a much more sophisticated manner, where a given neuron can take input from several different sources, and somewhere inside there's computational paths that figure out what should be output on what nodes, and from that it outputs these things on other nodes. This is really marvelous. So beautiful. I was talking to a friend this week about it. He had seen this actual podcast. And I said, I just love science. I just love it that people are able to figure these things out. And I said, all along the way, it just reminds me of the proverb that says, it is the glory of God to hide a thing and the glory of kings to seek it out. I had another buddy who made the comment, yeah, it's just amazing that random chance could come up with all that. Which it is, but, you know, my response to something like that is, well, yeah, but, you know, just because someone doesn't happen to believe in God doesn't mean they do bad science, or doesn't mean they don't do good science, I should say. And so, you know, my response to all this is the same response I've had in the past, which I've mentioned on this podcast. It's just like, wow, that's really fascinating. That is cool. Good job. You figured that out. Just keep go looking. Just keep looking. Because I am of the firm conviction that if people just keep looking long enough, that they are going to come to the conviction sooner or later that this is just too cool and too amazing to have happened all by itself. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.